Good morning. I'd like to call the Environmental Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. First order of business before us is the minutes from March 28th. Today's date is March 29th. I got that straight today. Representative Hanson, would you move the minutes, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes with one correction. I don't have my reading glasses here, but I did catch, I think my name is spelled H-A-N-S-E-N instead of S-O-N. So with that correction as amended, I would move the minutes.
Mr. Chair.
That would be the Swedish spelling, right?
Thank
you. Okay. Good. Okay, so with those that correction, any further discussion on the minutes? Representative Wagenius?
I just want to note for the minutes that I am recorded as a yes on one of the votes when I did pass, and you did put that in as a different sentence in here. But I did, the microphone will pick up that I did vote pass, not yes.
Okay. So noted. And that's why we put it in the minutes as it is. When the roll was taken on the amendment yesterday on the A6, after we had all gone through our voice vote for yay or nay, I looked at Ms. Zipko's tally and Karen's tally, and they were exactly the same, and so I said there being 13 or 9 A's and 13 nays, the amendment is not adopted. And then I gaveled it as official after the meeting was over and we adjourned. There was a conversation at the desk upstairs that Representative Wagenius had stated that she voted pass and not yes. So we also, I talked to Rick Hanson yesterday, Representative Hanson yesterday. I talked to Representative Wagenius last night about that. And I think we've come to a good place. So, thank you. So, all those in favor of the minutes as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Phew. Minutes are adopted. Okay. And speak into the microphone, please. Okay. First bill up today, Representative Torkelson has the House File 4269. This is the Clean Water Fund money is being appropriated. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you.
The motion would be to re-refer to Legacy Funding Finance.
Thank you for the motion, Mr. Chair. That is correct. As you may or may not recall, as part of last year's end of session negotiations, there was a provision put into statute that stated if we would have a surplus at the beginning of this session, that $22 million of the surplus would automatically be rolled into the Clean Water Fund. That is exactly what has occurred. So that then puts us in a position where we have that money plus other funds that have come into the Clean Water Fund during the interim, putting us at a total of $26,439,000 that's available for spending out of the Clean Water Fund this year and still maintain the agreed-upon 5% balance in the fund. The Clean Water Council has a budget outcomes committee. That committee has made recommendations to the legislature as to how these funds should be allocated or could be allocated this year. And if you've got a handout in your folders, that looks like this, says Clean Water Council on top and has a small spreadsheet part way down signed by the members of the Budget Outcomes Committee, by the chair and members of the council, and describes there in general what the recommended allocations are from the Clean Water Council. I'll run through those briefly. Drinking Water Protection Grants, $5 million goes to Bowser. Force of the Future, $1 million goes to DNR. one watershed, one plan. $4.412 million goes to Bowser. Return on investment is a new project at the University of Minnesota that is aimed at evaluating the effectiveness of clean water fund spending. That's $0.343 million CREP money for the CREP program, matching federal funds, is $15 million to Bowser, and they're a little bit short on the operating budget at PCA to keep the Clean Water Council operating, so they're requesting $10,000. I don't want you to misinterpret. It's not $10 million. It's just $10,000 additional funds for the operating budget at MPCA. Those are the recommendations that have come from the council, and those are the numbers that are in House File 4269 that I'm asking for support for today as we move this legislation on to the Legacy Committee.
Thank you. Members, questions? Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Torkelson, I have a couple different questions, if that's okay. First is on the CREP program. And I know that there's been a freeze on CRP, which matches with the RIM program at the federal government, and the Farm Bill will be expiring, but there's a cap on CRP. With that cap on CRP, are we still able to access those federal funds if there is a limit on the total acres?
Representative Torkelson?
Yes, I believe we are, but I'm going to have to phone a friend to make sure I get it right, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I hesitate to speak in detail, and I am not exactly sure of the details.
Your friend has arrived.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members, Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, you're correct. The CRP was suspended by the federal government this fall. It does not include the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, so CREP is still taking applications for work, and that is done both federally and statewide.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Becker-Kadelka, so with the appropriations that were passed in the law last year and the sign-ups that are occurring, do you have demand for the $15 million.
Ms. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, representatives, the CREP dollars are all part of this state and federal match together to build the program, and so it's an ongoing program. We've already had over $34 million in applications come in.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on that, of the $34 million in requests, how many have been awarded with the money that you've received already?
Ms. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have the exact amount. I can get that for you right away after the hearing. But it's the majority of it. It's a targeted amount, and so what we're doing is we are looking at the applications that are on the most environmentally sensitive and critical land, and so if the application meets the scoring and ranking criteria, then it proceeds forward. If it doesn't, if it's a lower scoring application that does not meet the environmental criteria, that's the only time that those are not processed.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. And I think it's important to note that there are other CREP initiatives moving forward this session. There's a $50 million allocation in the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Bill, and there's a $30 million request from the governor in bonding. We, of course, don't know the fate of either of those, but there's been money coming from a variety of sources to fund this. And this $15 million that's been recommended by the Clean Water Council actually reflects another request of the governor.
Jeff Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Torkelson, on that point, if the 15 plus 15 plus 30, does that meet our complete obligation?
I'm going to phone a friend again.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. So the remaining state match is at $59 million, and so 15 plus 15 plus 30 will get us there.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on a different question, as long as Ms. Becker-Cadelka is there, on the drinking water restoration grants, do we, in last year's appropriation, was there money for drinking water?
Ms. Becker-Cadelka.
Mr. Chair and Representative, last year the legislature appropriated money through Bowser to go out to local governments, and the appropriations for surface water and drinking water protection and restoration grants. And so this one focuses in on drinking water only. And so that one was not fully funded from the ask. So this one is a restoration of that, but focuses in on drinking water only.
Mr. Hansen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Becker-Cadelka, with the Hennepin Conservation District going away several years ago and with the potential for the Ramsey Conservation District going away, both with the drinking water protection restoration grants and the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, are the residents of those two counties eligible or is it applicable where they can apply for either the drinking water or the CREP grants in Hennepin and Ramsey County?
Ms. Becker-Cadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, the Ramsey County Conservation District process is moving ahead with Ramsey County. And yes, they would be eligible for the drinking and surface water restoration and protection grants, as is Hennepin County. They are not in the CREP area. The CREP area is that ag area, so they would not be eligible for CREP. They would be eligible for surface and drinking water. And Mr. Chair and Representative, I think there might be one correction to the surface and drinking water restoration and protection grants. I want to make sure that we've got the right. I think the Clean Water Council focuses in on drinking water only, or is it drinking and surface water? I'm just...
looking for it. It's for both, yes.
Mr. Chair and members, yes. It looks like the Clean Water Council focuses in on drinking water. It looks like the language in the bill says both. And the Board of Water and Soil Resources is open to work with, however the language proceeds, to work to focus in on the drinking water recommendations.
So are you referring to line 2.2?
Yes.
Okay. And then Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, in regard to this point, if you look on the larger spreadsheet that has lots and lots of numbers on it, on page 1 of that spreadsheet, line 51, where the surface and drinking water protection restoration grants are listed, as you run across, you'll see that last year's bill was, the final bill was $5 million less than the governor's recommendations and $10 million less than the council's recommendations. Of this $5 million allocation refills some of that request.
From Jim Hansen.
Ms. Becker-Cadelka, you mentioned the CREP being eligible in the ag area. I'm thinking of ag areas in the metro area, for example, around Hastings with the shallow sand aquifers, and I'm thinking about Washington County where we have drinking water issues. Are those counties eligible for CREP?
Ms. Becker-Cadelka.
Chair, Representatives, the CREP area agreement that was signed with the federal government it's a 54 county area in the state of Minnesota, and so those counties are not included in the 54 county area. We originally, and this has been 2 years ago, we tried to have the whole state put in because we thought the whole state would benefit from this, but within negotiations with the federal government, we ended up having a smaller area fit. They do not accept statewide applications.
Jim Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But would the drinking water grants be eligible for Dakota County and Hastings and Washington County, the appropriation that starts on line 2.1?
Ms. Becker-Cadelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, they would be eligible.
And finally, Mr. Jeff Chair, Hansen. So on 2.2, looking at the following clauses, it talks about water quality, but The discretion here is given to the board to restore surface water and drinking water, and I think the testimony was that this appropriation was for drinking water. Is it appropriate to do an oral amendment to take surface water and the three words surface water and out so that it reads for grants to protect and restore drinking water?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you would turn to the first sheet that we looked at, the back side of that that lists the verbiage of the various allocations. The title says drinking water, but if you read down into the paragraph, it does list both groundwater and drinking water in the paragraph. I'm assuming that, the leaving drinking water or leaving groundwater out of the title was just overlooked it. I think they meant to do both groundwater and drinking water in this appropriation. I'll be glad to verify that as we go to the legacy committee. I would not care to amend the bill at this time.
Sure. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the next stop is legacy?
Yes.
Yep, yes.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, we should continue the discussion on that.
Okay. Representative Wargini.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the One Watershed, One Plan grants, and I'm a big fan of One Watershed, One Plan, but I want to just raise a word of caution about the implementation of this money. So I live in the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District. It's a well-established district with a good reputation. And in the last, you may not think that.
Oh, I just sit in a lot of money. I didn't mean to interrupt.
In the last 3 years, we have had a growing problem in the lower part of the watershed district around Lake Nokomis, Lake Hiawatha, which is in my district. So more and more houses are getting water in their basements. Mature trees are being flooded and dying. Many sewer pipes are breaking because the groundwater level is so high. Sometime around Christmas, I was called because a major water main had broken and water was spewing out all over the streets. And, of course, when they came to repair it, they had to dewater because the groundwater was so high. They had to dewater the whole area in order to repair it. So the cost to my city of repairing stuff is way gone up because of high water. So as my community has been working through this problem and having many meetings with the Watershed District and DNR, Park Board, I mean, I have been to a huge number of meetings. It turns out that many decisions have been made about what we're doing with surface water without having a clue of understanding about what's going on in the groundwater. So we are now looking at trying to understand at what point in making all these decisions about surface water did it kind of pile on and say, uh-oh, water is backing up in this part of South Minneapolis, groundwater level is high, and now what do we do? And you know there's a lot of tension over this. We have at least 80 houses that where the basements are flooding and stuff like that. And I've represented this area long enough to know that this is a brand new problem. There are people who've lived in this neighborhood for 40 and 50 years and said, this never happened before. So I am now sensitive to groundwater issues in a watershed district. And when we were in Clean Water Council, just this last one, which was about a week ago, we heard from the Yellow Medicine Watershed District, and they went through a plan that was about 40 pages long and very complicated. And about halfway through talking about that plan, they said, well, one of the things we're going to be doing now is getting an atlas done for understanding groundwater. So the plan based on ignorance. I was just stunned that we are making surface water plans without understanding groundwater in this day and age. So as we're spending this money, are you going to be talking to your folks about understanding groundwater before they make surface water decisions?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree with you that groundwater is key and critical, and the interactions between surface water and groundwater are complex. And so, absolutely, these plans and the Yellow Medicine Plan that you referenced does have a component of groundwater in the plan, but as you said, there's so much that's still unknown that still needs to be learned. And so these plans do incorporate the knowledge that we have at the time to try to make the best decisions, recognizing that considerable more knowledge and understanding is still needed to move these plans forward. And so I guess if your question is will these plans consider groundwater, the short answer is that yes, and that they absolutely are looking at what are those interactions and what are the types of activities that can be done.
Representative Wagner, yes?
Well, that's actually not my question. We have done atlases in much of the state, not all of it. It does seem as we're prioritizing who gets the money for these plans that we should be giving money to watershed districts that already have atlases and that are going to have enough knowledge to actually understand the interrelationship between their groundwater and surface water. It's just a matter of priority and not making plans when an atlas hasn't been done. If you could answer, will you be prioritizing?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are many, many factors that go into when a group of local governments apply for a One Watershed, One Plan grant. And so we are not involved in the county atlas allocations or appropriations to the, our agency isn't involved in that process. However, there's many, many factors that go involved, including readiness and where folks are at in their planning stages right now. And so I think prioritizing involves all of those different pieces and may include, you know, may include where a county is at in their surface or drinking water understanding. It may include where that county or watershed district is at in their ability to start a planning process, among other things.
Representative Wagenius.
So I'm understanding from you that you are going to go ahead and give grants to counties, since it's a limited amount of money, that do not have atlases yet. Many of our counties do. Many of our watersheds do. Current best practice believes and understands and states again and again that there's water, surface water and groundwater are one. They are not two. They are one. They interrelate. They interact. That's best practices. Best practices from 1990 separates them. But this isn't 1990. So I am really concerned about your answer, because you should be doing 2018-19, not 1990. So that concerns me that we are not taking groundwater into, not seeing it as one water at this point. We're seeing it as two.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Members, Representative, this money, just to clarify, this money does not go towards planning. So this money was directed to go towards implementation. So these are for plans and metro plans and one watershed, one plans that have been completed. So these are not planning dollars. They won't go towards planning. They go towards the implementation of those plans.
Representative Wagenius.
Then let's look at what the language actually says, though. We can go into this again, but on your sheet, mm-hmm. It talks about should organize. That sounds like develop and develop focused develop focused implementation plans. So it looks like it, part of it's to develop plans to me. So perhaps the language needs to be tightened.
This is going to legacy funding and finance, and if you know you want to get together and talk about this offline before you go to the next stop, we could do that, if that's all right. Okay. Anything else, members? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 4269 be passed to legacy.
All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? You're on your way. Representative Clark Bruin Johnson. And then Susan. Okay, good. Members, this is the lands bill. Representative Johnson, welcome.
Thank you.
Ms. Damon, welcome. How would you like to proceed with your bill, Representative Johnson? It's going to Ways and Means.
Okay, I'd like to move the bill and then move the amendment.
Okay, so the motion is from Representative Johnson is to re-refer House File 3424 to Ways and Means. And at this time, then, we would also like to move the A4 amendment. To get the bill in the shape that the author would like. Those in favor of the A4 amendment, say aye, please.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment's adopted. The bill's in the shape you'd like. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, as one of many Minnesotans who values our public lands and respects the work of the DNR and their stewardship of those lands, it's an honor to present the lands bill today. I have with me Susan Damon, the Assistant Director for DNR Lands and Minerals Division, and I'd like her to walk us through the bill.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, again, for the record, my name is Susan Damon, Assistant Director of the Division of Lands and Minerals. So first I'll walk through the bill as introduced, and then I'll walk through the amendment.
Very good.
So Section 1 of House File 3424 amends Minnesota Statute Section 89.17, which governs the leases of forest land. This law currently allows the commissioner to require a performance bond to protect the state from the cost of removing improvements or personal property left by former lessees. This amendment to 8917 would expand the types of security that may be used for this purpose, as it may be difficult for some individuals to get a performance bond. Section 2 amends Minnesota Statute Section 92.50, which pertains to miscellaneous leases on lands administered by the DNR. And this amendment to Section 9250 makes the security provisions identical to those in Section 89.17. Section 3 of the bill amends Minnesota Statute Section 94.10 subdivision 2 pertaining to public sale. requirements for surplus state land, and this would allow public sales to be conducted through online auction. The purpose of this amendment is to increase sales of surplus state land by increasing public participation in the sales. Section 4 provides for additions to state parks. There are two additions to Frontenac State Park in Goodhue County. In Subdivision 1, there would be an addition of 158 acres of land to the boundary of the park. The land is adjacent to the existing state park boundary, and this is a parcel that is owned by the Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota, and the Parks and Trails Council wishes to convey this land to the DNR. Subdivision 2 adds 103 acres of existing state land to the boundary of Frontenac State Park. This land is currently part of the Perched Valley WMA, but is closed to hunting. And the DNR has determined that it would make more sense to have this 103-acre parcel managed as part of the park instead of as part of the WMA. Subdivision 3 adds 30 acres to Minneopa State Park and closes a gap between two existing areas in the current state park boundary. Subdivision 4 adds 64 acres to St. Croix State Park's boundary, and this addition was identified as part of a master plan to add land to the park south of Trunk Highway 48. Section 5 of the bill deletes land from the St. Croix State Park boundary. A 20-acre parcel is deleted, and this was also part of the master plan, and there was a determination in the master plan that land north of Trunk Highway 48 should be removed from the state park boundary. Section 6 pertains to additions to two state forests. The Bedura State Forest in Hubbard County is in Subdivision 1, and this amendment would add 1,120 acres to the state forest boundary. This addition includes lands that the DNR acquired in 2016. Subdivision 2 adds approximately 4,400 acres to the Snake River State Forest boundary. And this addition includes lands that were acquired in a 2016 land exchange between the state and Kennebec County. And Section 7 of the bill repeals 2008 Minnesota Laws, Chapter 368, Article 1, Section 21, Subdivision 2. This 2008 law provided for deletion of land from Jay Cook State Park upon an agreement with the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to transfer the land for use as a veterans cemetery. And the Department of Veterans Affairs has now determined that that location is not suitable. They're pursuing a different location, and so the law is no longer needed. Moving on to the A4 amendment. Section 3 authorizes the Commissioner of Natural Resources to lease DNR-administered land for 30 years for recreational trails and facilities. It also authorizes Lake and St. Louis counties to lease tax-forfeited lands for 30 years for recreational trails and facilities. These changes will enable Lake County to lease DNR-administered lands and tax-forfeited lands for the Prospectors Loop ATV Trail. The trail will be developed with state bond funds, and the use of state bond funds requires a minimum of a 25-year lease term. Section 5 authorizes mixed uses within the unincorporated areas of Welch and Goodhue County with a conditional use permit, provided that all other requirements of Goodhue County's Scenic River Ordinance are met. Section 6 amends Minnesota Laws 2015, Chapter 25, Section 7, and that law authorized Cass County to sell by private sale a number of tax-forfeited parcels to the city of Pillager for no consideration. This amendment simply adds one parcel to the 2015 law. The assessed value of that parcel is $57,000. Section 7 amends Minnesota Laws 2017, Chapter 93, Article 2, Section 155, Subdivision 4. That law required the Commissioner of Natural Resources to convey a road easement to Oreck Township in Sherburn County over an existing road on state land that the township maintained within Sand Dunes State Forest. The amendment expands the easement area to other existing roads maintained by the township on state land. These are acquired lands. And it also clarifies that the easement conveyance must be at no cost to the township. And then lines 2.29 and 2.30 are corrections to the legal description in House File 3424 in the Snake River State Forest boundary change. Section 11 authorizes the DNR to sell a one-acre parcel in Chisago County outside of the statutory boundary of Wild River State Park to an adjacent landowner. This parcel was included in a 2017 DNR acquisition of other land that is within the state park boundary. The estimated value of the parcel is $3,350. Section 12 authorizes the DNR to sell a 40-acre parcel of land in Manoman County at market value to the White Earth Band of Chippewa. This land is formerly tax-forfeited land that the DNR acquired in 1971 through a resolution from the county board. The land is not needed for natural resources purposes by the DNR. The estimated value of this parcel is $64,999. Section 12 provides for the grant of an easement to cross state land in Pelican Township in Otter Tail County at no cost. The DNR is going to build a new water access site on Lake Lizzie, and that will require a segment of existing township road to be vacated. The easement across state land will reroute and replace the vacated township road segment. Section 13 authorizes the DNR to sell a 2.4-acre parcel of land bordering Cedar Lake in Rice County. This parcel was acquired in 1996 by gift along with an island that became the Whitney Island Scientific and Natural Area. The sale parcel is not part of the SNA and is not needed for natural resource purposes. The current assessed value of that property is $11,800. Section 14 authorizes the DNR to sell 3.3 acres of land to Brighton Township in St. Louis County at no cost. These lands were removed from the boundary of Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine State Park in 2013. And then Section 15 authorizes Brighton Township in St. Louis County to sell the DNR a one-acre parcel of land. Actually, there are two parcels comprising 1 acre within the Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground State Park boundary at no cost. The acquisition and sale will enable the DNR to align state ownership of land of park property along McKinley Park Road. And finally, Section 16 pertains to private sale of tax-forfeited land by St. Louis County, and it authorizes St. Louis County to sell 9 parcels of tax-forfeited land by private sale. The total assessed value of these parcels is $1,339,300. So with that, I'll be happy to answer questions.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the amendment on Section 7, we've been working for quite some time to resolve some right-of-way issues in the Sand Dunes State Forest, and I just want to find out if we've really, if we've got those resolved, or if this takes care of the right-of-way issue, or is there you know, what's the status on that? I know there's been a lot of work done on that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Meyer, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, DNR. This does resolve that issue. The other part we need is the school trust piece and working on that payment of the other part of the easement. We do need to probably tweak this language between here and ways and means just to make sure that we're representing the trust in the best possible fashion and not causing confusion. So there might be just a small adjustment to this language between now or in the Ways and Means Committee. So otherwise, it does what we need to do. I just want to make sure that the Office of School Trust Lands is completely comfortable with the language as well. So,
Representative Lewis, and to this point, I think Representative Neuberger has, am I wrong?
I would say a lot of work has been done here in trying to unsnarl a pretty lengthy historical issue on who's on the road and who's not on the road.
Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Myers. I appreciate the DNR's working with us on this, and I look forward to moving ahead and getting this final wrinkle taken care of in Ways and Means. And again, I just want to say thank you to the department. Shows that we can get something done here. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Just a 2-second update on what the solution is. The department and Division of Forestry is willing to transfer the easement at no cost to the township and also waive the application. We had some of the language in here in other bill as well. And then we're working on the trust compensation easement piece as well. So it's kind of a win-win for both parties.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is just kind of technical. I was following along here, and I want to make sure I have the right amendment because after Section 12, my numbers got off.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to clarify that to make sure that we're on the same page.
Ms. Taylor, do you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chair, I haven't noticed an error, but there is a... on line 7.33, an instruction to read for section. So if there is any issue, the revisor will take care of it. But I can look through and see if I can identify what.
Representative Green, could you be more specific?
Well, after she referenced section 12 for Monoma County, then she also said section 12 grant an easement for Otter Tail County, and she ended up with 16 sections, and my bill shows 17.
Mr. Chair,
okay.
Representative Green, I apologize if I mixed up the sections. There were some sections being moved around as of yesterday, and I might not have updated my notes.
I heard the same thing, but I looked at the numbers, and they did seem to be correct to me. But
okay.
Thank you. I'm sure the staff is nailed real well. Thank you. Representative Karen Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wondered what the reason was for deleting the 20 acres from the St. Croix State Park.
Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, there was a master plan that added acres in one part and deleted acres. So it added acres south of Trunk Highway 48 and then deleted acres north to make Trunk Highway 48 the boundary of the park. There's an addition as well.
Representative Clark.
So is there a limit then to the amount of land that can be in the park? Is that what I'm hearing? And so therefore, since you added some, you had to take some out. Is that the way that works?
Director Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, we acquire lands only within the state park boundary. So it's not a limit on acre. It's a determination of where that boundary exists, and that 20 acres that is being deleted is currently not in state ownership and has never been in state ownership. It's in private ownership, but is currently in the state park boundary. We don't own all of the land within the state parks. There are numerous inholdings within state park boundaries.
Thank you,
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I'll try to understand it more later.
Okay. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on lines 3.28 and 3.29.
The amendment or the bill, I'm sorry?
To the amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. A federally recognized Indian tribe acquiring land under this section must pay the property taxes for the lands acquired. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because I don't know that we can order them to do that.
Director Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, it's my understanding that the White Earth Band has agreed to pay those taxes.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would suggest as this goes through the process that the way this is worded right now makes it sound like we're ordering them to do that. Maybe something along the lines of, memorializing that they've agreed to do this would be more appropriate than stating that we can, as a Minnesota legislature, require a sovereign nation to pay taxes. And I'm glad to hear that there's agreement on the issue, but encourage Representative Johnson to maybe clarify that going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you, Representative Becker-Finn. We've got it. This was language written fairly late in the game yesterday, and I think the important thing is that there's an agreement where the tribe is, or the band rather, has chosen to make that payment. But I share your recognition that this is a challenge. We need to figure out a better way to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, I think the idea that we have online auctions or bringing the DNR sales into 2018 is timely and a good idea. So I want to thank you for that. I think a lot of auctions have that in the private world, and so bringing those into the current reality, I think, is a good step. So thank you.
I've heard that the auction site is j-bid.com. Is that true, Johnson?
No, kidding.
That's why you're hiring.
Yeah. Director Damon, I have a question on the bill. On page 2, where we're changing language, where the commissioner may require a performance bond, and then the language changes, security deposit or other, on premises where there's leases or upon cancellation or termination. I have a few people in the district that I represent and near there in the Beltrami Island State Forest that have leases on a piece of property. There's a small cabin or something there. And quite frankly, they're very important for people that are ATVing and snowmobiling, and it can be a place of shelter and whatnot during some bad weather. How would this impact those types of properties?
Mr. Chair, this language is not mandatory, so we would look at the circumstances of each lease. If we were going to ask for security, it would be upon a new lease or a renewal of an existing lease. The DNR did have a situation where there was a house on a parcel of school trust land, and the owner passed away, and to demolish the house and remove a lot of debris from the premises cost the DNR over $80,000. And so that's the impetus for this language to protect the state coffers.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate that. I just don't want it to become something that would possibly cause someone to just throw up their hands and say, no, I'm not renewing this lease again. I don't want it to be. I want it to be friendly. Thank you. Any other thing on the bill, members? Okay. So with that, I will renew Representative Johnson's motion to re-refer House File 3424 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? You're on your way, Representative Johnson. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Damon. Okay. Now, the moment we've all been waiting for. Representative Green, welcome. Good morning, Kurt. You look good today. You're welcome. Representative Green, House File 3874. The plan here is to lay this bill over. And if you would walk us through your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The bill was brought, the idea was brought to me by the young man sitting next to me. He was reading on the problems that we're having in the United States with feral swine, and he had some ideas, and I said, you get the ideas drafted, and tell me what you want, and we'll get a bill put together, and you come down and testify. And so, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn this testimony over to my testifier.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Well, you're welcome. And people should know that this your grandpa is doing a nice thing for you here. So, very good. And I'd do the same thing someday, I hope. Go ahead, Kurt.
My name is Kurt Green.
And proceed. Thank you.
This bill is allowing people basically just to keep the meat from their feral swine after they've shot it, and they have to report it to the DNR in a 24-hour period, and a person is not allowed to release the feral swine into the state or to let them run at large. The person may not hunt or trap them. Well, the purpose of the bill is to keep the swine out of the state.
I like that.
And I'll take questions.
Questions, members? I have a couple, but Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. To the testifier, I understand that this is an international problem. Are there any neighboring countries that have a feral swine infestation?
There are.
Good.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, they are in Mexico, Canada, Europe, and basically just about every other country around the world.
Thank you, Torkelson.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to know.
Other questions, members? Dr. Pitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to congratulate Mr. Green on presenting. I'm assuming this is the first bill you've presented. Sometimes members don't even get to present bills in committee, so congratulations, and you're doing a really good job. So, thank you.
I got Representative Hansen on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Green. Representative Green, I have a couple of questions, or at least I'd like to know what the DNR thinks about the bill. And
we don't care.
Well, and you know, I know it's it is a very important topic because we cannot allow feral swine to be getting a beachhead in our state. So, I'd like to know if this enhances current law or if it weakens current law, and your opinion that I value as well. So, if you have Mr. Green, and but I'd also like to hear from DNR.
Kirk, what's your opinion?
I believe that allowing people to keep the hog would people would be more likely to report their feral swine after it's been shot, to bring it in without the fear of losing it and having to turn it over.
Okay. Mr. Leach, I see you're sitting here. DNR have, I think Representative Hansen has, in an indirect way, asked you to come down and testify.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Jim Leach. I'm the director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife for DNR. And DNR does have an opinion, and I'm in the dubious, the awkward position of basically saying DNR would oppose this legislation for a number of reasons. As we all know, feral swine are a threat to public lands, private lands. They are a significant carrier of disease and parasites that can be transmitted to humans, domestic livestock, pets, and wildlife. Should feral swine ever become illegally established in Minnesota, I think the proper technique for eradicating is through public entities not having individuals of the public shoot individual swine and possessing them. Not allowing hunting, taking, or possessing of feral swine discourages the intentional illegal introduction of swine in Minnesota. Under subdivision 2B of the proposed legislation, an individual who takes a feral swine is allowed to possess the species. This subdivision establishes a tolerance for and a potential incentive for individuals to illegally establish feral swine in Minnesota. Eliminating the surrender clause of existing statute eliminates DNR's ability to do genetic testing of the species and to document the origin of importation. Due to existing carcass restrictions and surrender requirements, DNR has been able to test two feral swine that were taken in southern Minnesota, documenting that both of these swines originated from Texas. For those reasons, Mr. Chair and Committee, DNR would not support this legislation.
Representative Brian Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Green, I actually want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I have seen the damage these feral hogs can do to not only agricultural land, but also our state land. They literally destroy the stuff. They destroy it for other animals. I believe we need to do whatever we can to keep these animals out of the state of Minnesota. And we have two fronts. They're coming from Canada, working their way down where they think those feral pigs and swine can actually survive the harsh winters that we have. But we also have them coming up from Texas. So we need to get a handle on this, and we need to get a handle on it right now. I believe if we can eradicate them any way possible, it's going to be the best for the state of Minnesota.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concerns were addressed by the DNR. I didn't particularly like the response, though.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to address some of the concerns of the DNR as well. Right now, you can shoot a feral swine. It's legal to shoot them right now. What this bill does is our hope is that by allowing people to keep them legally, they would still have to notify the DNR, and we have spoken with the DNR and would be more than happy to add in that there should be testing, and we agree with that the carcasses of the brain stem should be tested for disease. This is something that, as the DNR has testified, we already have them in Minnesota. And it's, if you've seen, I mean, this young man has brought more information on this than I thought I would ever know about swine, but if you see the way they are in the other states, they're like rats. They breed very fast, and once they get a foothold, it's almost impossible to eradicate them. And if we've taken two, that tells me we probably have more. And so the idea is that if we can get if we can encourage people, if they know that, yeah, they might be able to keep that meat if they choose to, they might be more apt to report that swine. And we also have some information that was passed out to you in your packets that shows the map of how they expanded up to 2010.
Good work, Kurt. Thank you for raising a very important issue. I don't know what conversations you've had with DNR with regards to your bill, but I see the bill was first introduced on the 15th, and today is the 29th. Director Leach, what conversations have you had with Kurt and Representative Green?
Mr. Chair, members, to my knowledge, there hasn't been discussion. Representative Green, I'd ask you, I'm not sure who you've been talking with, so it wasn't me, so I don't know who.
Representative Green.
The idea of having the testing done was brought to me not only by the pork producers, but I believe I had some conversations with Bob Myers. I don't remember the whole conversation, but one of the things that was expressed to me was just the very fact that the bill is coming up would bring awareness to Minnesotans that this is creeping into our state and it is serious. And the idea of the bill, like we said before, is not to establish a hunting season. We hope that never has to happen. Our hope is to make sure that we kill them before they get a foothold.
Well, in Northwest Minnesota, we have the three S's. So, Representative Kudzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to the testifier, Mr. Green. Just a question, kind of, on other states and other provinces, what's the best method for eradication? What have they used? What are they doing? What are they allowing?
Well, there's a number of different ways to take care of them. A very effective way is using live traps in large corrals and camouflaging them and spending some time getting information on that group and collecting them all, and then using thermal optics and night vision to go in and shoot the remaining hogs that are left after being taken from the trap, and helicopter hunting.
Ooh, I like that. Okay, Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Green, would you share bacon with the committee if this bill passes and you got one?
I might.
Good answer.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Green. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. It sounds like another way to attack the problem. And my question is actually to the DNR is, I'm hearing the options of being able to test, and I know that with the chronic wasting disease, testing is done along that way, and people are able to keep the carcass. Is there a similar program that could be adapted to address the feral pig situation here so that they could keep the carcass?
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, I think there's ways that we could do that, similar to what we're doing with CWD. That would be really future discussions that I think we would have to have, but I think there's possibilities of doing that. It would require additional, obviously, DNR input, but I think there's possibilities to do something similar to that.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the DNR, I would encourage you and the author and the testifier to get together to figure that out, because I think that'd be a great common sense way to bring the sides together to help get us another tool in the toolbox to address a problem out there and give the tools that the DNR needs to track what's going on.
Northwest Minnesota common sense, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Representative Wick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Green, for bringing this to our attention. I just would have a suggestion for the DNR. Maybe we ought to go back and review the procedures we had dealing with tuberculosis in the Great Northwest, which took about 5-6 years to eradicate that out of the white-tailed deer, how we dealt with those carcasses, what we did with the meat, where it was acceptable. And also, we've got a pretty robust and understandable process for dealing with testing deer for chronic wasting disease. And so it would seem like we already know how to do this with that 24-hour notification requirement in there. That gives the DNR the opportunity to go, view the carcass and take whatever test they would seem appropriate. I think today you can spit in a tube and do the DNA thing. I know for other diseases, obviously a spinal cell or a piece, you know, may be necessary, which would probably be beyond the capability of the average citizen. So I would suggest that the issue of what ultimately ends up with the carcasses is not that big an issue as long as we're encouraged to absolutely obey that 24-hour notice and get a professional out to look at the carcass. One, to verify, in fact, it is a feral hog, because with the wide variety of swine we have out there now, some of them even as pets, people get them confused with dogs. So I think there's a, I think in the agency there's probably room to resolve that issue of making sure we know exactly what we got and do what testing is necessary and not in a circumstance where just automatically they're going to have to surrender the carcass and can't get it back. So that's just a suggestion for the agency.
Thank you. Representative Hockey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green and Mr. Green. I don't know if this is the right exact bill or a combination of working with the DNR, but I'm glad you brought this up. I have been to a number of national sportsmen's conferences, and they hate feral hogs. I'm not aware of one state where they have them, where they've been able to eradicate them. They will do, if they get to Minnesota, millions or billions of dollars worth of crop damage, and we won't be able to get rid of them. So I'm glad you're bringing attention to this. This is a huge deal in every state where they have it, and we need to make sure it doesn't get established here.
Representative Hanson, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, the challenge here is the approach of what works. And so Mr. Green is proposing that if we allow the keeping, that would encourage reporting. All of the things talking about testing and that, those aren't free. So then we're going to have to appropriate money to do the testing. We're going to have rapid response. So the best way to deal with feral hogs is to prevent them from getting established. Otherwise, the cleanup costs will continue to grow once they're established. And I think there's two different types of feral hogs. One are the European boars that are brought into the country for hunting, and then there is the incidental escape of whether it's a pet or whether it's a commercial livestock. And if those hogs remain in the wild for a couple generations, they go wild. And so you may have when we're dealing with invasive species, and this would be invasive species, people moving them around, letting their favorite pet go when they can't take care of it anymore, is also a potential problem. So the debate here is not whether or not we want to try to keep wild boar or feral hogs out of the state, but what works. So if keeping the meat, the question is, if keeping the meat would encourage the reporting, to encourage that people are going to report that so that we can stop them, or does the existing situation where the carcass has to be surrendered? It would be interesting to see on the edge of that line with other states. I'm not talking about Texas or Louisiana, but on the fringe, what they are doing and what they're finding as it gets established. Maybe in Iowa, Illinois, some of those states where the fringe is moving in, what they're finding works with rapid response. Because following up on Representative Hoppe, if this starts, we're going to have the helicopters cost money. The people cost money. The tests cost money. So how do we keep this out? How do we keep these things out? And how do we encourage that if there is escape or if people do release, we prevent them from getting established?
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hanson, I don't know that you can stop every bad behavior. I wish that we could, but I don't think that's possible. But what we're talking about here, and I hope we remain talking about it, is how to stop them from getting here in the first place. My testifier does have a little bit of information to address the fact that, how if it's helicopters or testing, it all costs money, but I'll let him address that.
Representative Mr. Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The damage caused in the United States annually so far with 9 million pigs in the United States is over $1.5 billion per year annually. Alabama had a problem, or has a problem, and it was $800 million per year. And they're spread through 39 different states. They're on all the borders, basically, surrounding us. And everywhere the pigs go, they cause millions of dollars worth of damage. And they have a liability of $200 per pig. And the females can breed twice a year, and they can have up to 14 piglets in a litter. So that's about 28 pigs per sow for several years. The oldest known sow able to breed was able to breed at 14 years of age.
Very good.
They can reach maturity for breeding at 3 to 4 months.
Very good. Okay. Well, again, Mr. Green, thank you for bringing forth an extremely important issue to all Minnesotans, and especially sportsmen and landowners. And I applaud you on your effort to do this, and I encourage you to continue working on this, and hopefully we can get something to the House floor and to the governor's desk someday. Keep up the great work. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, the bill's laid over. Thank you. Okay, next, we've got House File 2732. Representative Erickson is here. The chair's intention is to lay this bill over. Representative Erickson, I will move the DE1 amendment for you at this time to get the bill in the shape that you would like. Those in favor of the DE1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment's adopted, and the bill is in the order that you would like. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing this proposal. House File 2732, as amended, is a result of a discussion that Commissioner Landwehr and I had a couple of weeks ago. I have a very good working relationship with Commissioner Landwehr. Spend a great deal of time with him and others who head fisheries in our state as we work diligently with Blickwick on the 1837 ceded territory agreements that exist between the state and the eight bands. So you will see, members, that this is permissive. The commissioner may, doesn't have to, invite fish managers. He is the one who defines who a fish manager is. He would designate, and you may not know, but the chair has attended these technical meetings with me, as, of course, Representative Lewick. Representative Lewick and I represent Lake Mille Lacs. That's the prime fishing spot that 1837 is concerned with. And Representative Heitzman has attended, as has Senator Brood and Senator Ingebrigtsen. And I think that's the entire lineup, plus we've had staff. My attendance has been at the request of the governor, so I continue to attend these technical meetings, and I know the commissioner really appreciates my input as I observe and give him feedback, and Don Ferrer as well, and other fisheries experts. So that, Mr. Chair, in a nutshell, is this proposal, and as I said, it's permissive, and it's designated by the commissioner.
Thank you. Member questions, comments? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is actually a question for research. So this bill is about the Fisheries Technical Committee, which is different than the Advisory Committee, just for the public's benefit regarding Mille Lacs. And I'm wondering if research, can you talk about what the mechanism is by which this technical committee was set up in the first place, as far as, was it legislation, was it agreement, was it court order? If you could enlighten us, that would be helpful.
Ms. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members, I know it wasn't legislatively mandated. There's nothing in statute. And
I don't remember the history that either be, you know, I know the some of the groups were court-ordered, but I don't know if this particular one was.
Representative Beckerkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will point members to a letter that was in our materials from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, so GLIFWIC. And to be honest, I've been working with the reference library for the last couple days trying to answer that question about where the technical committee was originally set up. And it does reference, so this letter references protocol number one, and then has states how the committee was supposed to be set up. And according to this letter, you know, it's a government-to-government basis by which the technical committee was set up. So, you know, it's... It may, you know, if it was set up by court order, I don't know if that protocol one is in reference to a court order. Maybe Representative Erickson's shaking her head. Could you speak to, maybe you know the history of where the technical committee, where that came from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beckerkin, when the Supreme Court ruled in 1999 in a 5-4 ruling that those who fished, hunted and gathered in the 1837 treaty area still had those rights. What the court did say is the state of Minnesota and these eight bands get together and make some decisions about how you should handle this decision by the Supreme Court. And so protocols were written, and you're correct, one of the protocols does deal with having a fisheries technical committee. Because remember, members, that the state of Minnesota has a co-management or a collaboration on fish harvest management only dealing with the 1837. So it's dealing with the harvest management that's the focus. And protocols needed to be put in place so that there was a structure to follow. And those protocols are what the DNR and a GLIFWIC was the umbrella for the eight bands follows. So it was not a court order. It was a decision made between the two parties.
Representative Beckerkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it would be helpful to see, you know, it sounds like there was a written agreement between the state of Minnesota, DNR, and GLIFWIC. And that would be really helpful to see because the language here doesn't look like, again, that we as the state can order Mille Lacs or GLIFWIC to do anything. And so, Representative Erickson, did you, as you were putting together this language, I'm happy to hear that you consulted with Commissioner Landwehr. Did you also speak with GLIFWIC or Mille Lacs directly?
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, I didn't speak directly with GLIFWIC, but I talked to GLIFWIC quite often. At the technical meetings, they know that that I have a passion for making sure that our legislative representatives can attend, and they appreciate that. And the protocols are a number, and that is an agreement between the bands and the state. So, to answer your question, I guess no, I haven't talked to them directly, but I've spoken to them privately.
Representative Beckerkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, if this is a committee between sovereign nations and the state of Minnesota, it's really helpful to talk to each of those entities about issues like this instead of you know, going forward without talking to them, because it sounds like there's already an agreement that the House and Senate chairs of the environment committees are permitted to observe but not participate in the meetings. And, you know, you mentioned yourself and Representative Heinzman and Chair Fabian have attended those meetings. So I'm just not sure what we're doing here when one of the parties to this agreement hasn't been consulted with and isn't, you know, we have this letter from October 18th, 2017,
opposed to making any changes to those previous agreements. So I guess I'm just not sure why we need to legislate something that we may not be able to even enforce against a sovereign nation.
Mr. Erickson.
Well, we represent the state of Minnesota. We don't represent the eight bands under the agreement. We represent the state of Minnesota. And this is permissive language for the commissioner, if he chooses, to bring the same kind of observers that the bands bring to these technical meetings. And if the commissioner decides not to, he doesn't have to. But he will make the decision. Or if it's someday a female, she will make the decision. So this is totally permissive, and it's in the hands of the commissioner.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, even if the commissioner, current commissioner or future commissioner, chooses to exercise this, by doing this without agreeing with Glyphwic and the tribes, if the tribes are opposed to it, it's not going to work. We can't make the tribes add additional requirements to their nation-to-nation agreement regarding the setup of the technical committee. We do not have jurisdiction to order the tribes to do anything.
Mr. Chair, this is permissive, yes. And this is for state vote. This is permissive.
Sure.
This is the commissioner's group.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I understand that the fisheries technical committee, though, is not a standalone DNR committee. If this was a committee set up by the state and by the DNR on their own, they would certainly have the authority to do that. But we, as the state of Minnesota, cannot force changes to agreements with other nations. It's legally, we have no jurisdiction to do that. So I understand that it's permissive. Certainly the amendment is much better than the original language. And I'll just, there are plenty of ways that the DNR can update folks on what's happening at these meetings. And, you know, it's clear that you've attended and folks have attended in the past. And, again, we can't, I just don't know what we're doing here with this bill. And I would really encourage you to communicate directly with your constituents who are Mille Lacs members and consult with the tribe and Glyphwic directly, because as I've said multiple times, you know, our native Minnesotans are Minnesotans too, and many of us represent those folks, and it's important that they be included in these discussions instead of legislating over things that we likely don't even have jurisdiction to change. So thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, this is permissive language, and it's in the hands of the commissioner.
Thank you. Representative Lick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Erickson, for bringing this to our attention. I guess as to a question about discussing this, this has been discussed since the Supreme Court ruling. So the idea that we're not consulting is far from the truth. This language simply makes it very clear to the Commission of Natural Resources that if he determines that he wants someone there to observe, doesn't say participate, it says attend, then he's allowed to do that, and not allowed to do that, but encouraged to do that. I have attended one of those meetings, after I observed that, I made a commitment to myself and my constituents, all of them, Native American and non-Native American, that I would not ever attend another one of those meetings unless either both groups specifically invited me or the Department of Natural Resources invited me. There's a gut-wrenching problem that's been going on there since the beginning of this. That is, people don't understand what the technical committee does. And you know, like it or not, this is Minnesota, and we have a long history of bright sunlight, observing at least how we make decisions. And I would suggest that rather than leaving the communities to speculate on what may or may not have taken place at these technical committee meetings, and then second-guessing whether the DNR is accurate in their portrayal of what happened. When we get the third and fourth-hand information, we all know where that leads. It leads to wild speculation and rarely close to the truth of what happened. So this is simply an opportunity here to make it very clear that if the commissioner decides that he wants to bring somebody that has lived on the lake their entire life, may very well have both educational and personal experience credentials that have to do with the fishery, that he can invite him to attend. I mean, this is really basic stuff. I would hope that if we can get to that point where there's an opportunity to open this up, that we would end some of the bitterness and divisiveness that's went on now for 20 years. Because, like it or not, when you can't see in the box, you're going to wonder what's in there and you're going to speculate on what's going on. And we've just got to end that. And that would be a real step forward for both parties in this situation. So, this provides the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner with the assurance that the state of Minnesota is behind him on a very simple thing, deciding who can accompany him or his representative into the room. Doesn't say they're going to participate, it says they're going to attend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, again, thank you for bringing this bill for our consideration. You know, one of the biggest things that we always talk about in this committee, and it's incumbent on us too, is transparency in government. And that's why we're holding these public hearings to the public and everything else. So, you know, this bill, I think that goes a long ways towards that and will eliminate a number of problems. If you read in some of the local papers and press about some of the issues that are, as Representative Hansen likes to say, in the dark of the night or whatever. But it is a little bit behind closed doors, and transparency in government is good. And this is not going to change the dynamics in any respect. These are observers that will be there. It's just better government for this panel. Thank you again, Representative Erickson.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question's on the letter from the commission. And I'm just wondering, because it talks about agreements, it's a little bit off topic, but Representative Erickson, you mentioned that a number of people have attended these meetings and for observing. And it looks to me that the agreement was with the House and Senate chairs. It talks about the House and Senate chairs of Environment and Natural Resources with jurisdiction that are permitted to observe. And then later on it says four particular legislators. So am I correct, Mr. Chair, that the four would be the chairs, but also Representative Erickson and Representative Lewick? Or I'm trying to count from two to four. I'm not quite.
Three. Representative Erickson.
Well, I'm not sure how this works.
I think the agreement that was reached informally a few years ago was chairs or their designees. But in conversations with the governor, he has said many times over that I'm the one who has the keenest interest in this. It is part of my district, and he would appreciate if I could attend. And just to add to that, my attendance and my interaction with both Blithwick and with the DNR has resulted in minutes being taken now at these technical meetings, and the minutes then are posted. And Blithwick, I must say, is very good about posting the minutes. You noticed in the original bill that I wanted the reference library, and I'm so glad to see Elizabeth Lincoln here today because I've worked with her, that because the DNR does not have an archival library, that the reference library was willing to take the documents that are collected from all the agreements that the DNR makes. They make hundreds of agreements all the time. I mean, their accumulation, I can't even imagine what it numbers. But, you know, if they so choose now, they can archive them in the reference library. But we've made great strides over the last few years on ensuring accountability and, as I've heard members say, transparency. And that's so important for us as lawmakers and policymakers here in the state of Minnesota, that when we have an agency, the DNR, involved in a treaty conclusion by the Supreme Court, that we are doing our utmost to make sure the people of Minnesota are engaged and understand what goes on. And the technical meetings are technical, and I've learned a great deal and have come to really understand what the DNR has to go through as they negotiate the harvest management, especially in particular walleye. We've made great strides, and I think it's really important that the chairs attend. But as the commissioner and I discussed, because the bands bring fish managers, if he would like to designate, if he would like to designate some fish managers, he may bring them.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think we have any fish managers around the table here, but my question is on kind of the formal, is there a formal notification that, you know, when control changes or there's changes in personnel, and you mentioned that Representative Heinzman went, Representative Lewick went, you know, how does that designate, does there have to be a formal notice to the group that here these folks are going to be attending as designated by the chair? I'm just following up on Representative Becker Finn's question about when we're collaborating with the sovereign nation, how much communication is there, or are people just showing up? And I understand when people represent in the area, but I don't know how this works. So how do we handle those changes if people, let's say if Representative Eklund was interested or Representative Becker Finn was interested, can they go? Does there have to be a formal process to notify? I don't know the answer to that, Mr. Chair.
I can address that slightly, and I'll represent Eric. I get a letter whenever, and there's four chairs on that letter. Myself, Representative Swedzinski, Chair Ingebrigtsen, and Chair Rood over in the Senate. I've asked a couple of times for Representative Heinzman to go to be my representative at the meetings. We are told on August when I went that we were told we were there to observe. The part about this being technical, I agree. I was reminded in the committee, I remember what it was, one night this week, that I'm a fire teacher and a track coach. That's what I was reminded of. I am not a scientist. Okay, and I was also reminded that I don't understand technical things at times, and I admit that. Okay, so I think it's helpful to have somebody else there. I mean, I'd love to have someone come with me who is a fisheries biologist, somebody who understands some of the conversation that's going on. And as Representative Ubrin referred to this whole process, and Representative Lewick, I think openness and transparency, and I think if Representative Eklund wanted to go, Representative Becker Finn wanted to go, I don't quite understand why there would be resistance to letting people just be there to observe what's going on. What's the big secret? And then, of course, the other thing that spurns some problems is the, quote, secret agreement that was reached and the documents were not released to the public for quite some time and someone just happened to stumble onto them. So these problems, you know, kind of grow and multiply. And I think, as we've said in this committee many times, that the openness and transparency in a process is good. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'm just so happy that you were able to hear this bill and that we've had this good discussion. I appreciate this time.
You're okay. You're fine. Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns I have with the bill as being presented here is I feel it's sending some messages that may not be intended along the line, or it feels like one of the messages I'm perceiving out of this is that we're minimizing the sovereign governments, the tribes out there, because we're mandating something in, and it,
And the reason I'm feeling this way is because I'm not seeing the reach out to the sovereign nations who are involved and saying, you know, this is what we'd like to be able to do and come up with something that's got peace in the valley. It feels very much like we've got a power dynamic here where we're trying to force something onto a situation instead of approaching them in a way that might be something that would be easily resolvable instead of having to go through a process like this. To me, it feels like we're being disrespectful to the sovereign nations by taking this approach without consulting and involving them in the process.
Thanks. Representative Beckerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just kind of a follow-up to some of the comments of Representative Lewick about this being, you know, kind of a gut-wrenching issue for a long time. And I imagine, you know, you were likely referring to how long some of the legal battles have gone on regarding Mille Lacs, but really we're talking about back to 1837 when the treaty was initially set up. And, you know, as we have outlined in the Supreme Court, and for everybody's edification, I'm talking about the Supreme Court of the United States. So this was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. In the opinion, they lay out, you know, some of the games that were played by the federal government with moving where annuity payments could be picked up. And in the meantime, around 150 Chippewa died in an outbreak of measles and dysentery. Another 230 Chippewas died on the winter trip home to Wisconsin. And this had to do with kind of playing games about where food and money could be picked up and then not handing out that money. So I bring that up because I think it speaks to the long-standing distrust from a lot of Native folks when it comes to things that are forced upon them. And so if we're really serious about coming to a place where we can move past some of the hard feelings, pushing legislation without conversations, you know, us dictating something, even, you know, and it's not necessarily like the language itself is not problematic. It's the way that we're doing this without there being agreement or even a conversation. You know, having spoken to somebody in the past about something else is not the same as addressing this specific issue. So, obviously, it's a really difficult issue, but forcing one side to do something is not how we reach a place where we can start to move past some of the hard feelings here. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I want you and members to know that the eight bands don't come to us and ask us. So, you know, these are two different entities, and I'm speaking on behalf of the state of Minnesota. That's the law that we have purview over. That's the policy over which we have purview. So, this is just the way it is. You know, I represent all people in my district. But as a policymaker, I'm here at the legislature working with the DNR, not with Glyphwood and not with the bands. I'm working with the DNR. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay, so with that, House File 2732 is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, members, that's it for now. When we come back after the Easter break, we'll have an agenda of stuff that will get posted when we get things done. If you have questions, you can check with me. Wish everybody a great break and a happy Easter, and thank you. We're adjourned.